You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, should America's farmers use their land to feed the country or supply power to it? What if they could do both? This week, Jen White is hosting 1A from California's San Joaquin Valley to hear from all sides of that debate and to hear more about where solar power is headed next. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now let's talk about a magic number in American politics, 435. That's the number of seats in the U.S. House of Representatives. That's been the number for over 100 years. With one little brief wiggle when Alaska and Hawaii became states, we quickly resettled on 435. But the population of the U.S. has gone up over that time from 92 million in 1910 to 331 million in the latest census. So congressional districts have gotten a lot larger. A bill in Congress would boost the number of representatives. Democratic Representative Earl Blumenauer of Oregon wants to add 150 seats after the next census and some more after that. It's not likely to pass, but why have we settled on 435? Is it worth adding some seats? Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Is it time to embiggen the House of Representatives? What do you like or not like about that idea? And do you have questions about why things are the way they are? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Stephen Smith joins us now. He's the Kate M. Gregg Distinguished Professor of Social Sciences and Professor of Political Science at Washington University. He's written a number of books on American politics and Congress. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you.
Let's start at the beginning. What does the Constitution say about how we figure out how many representatives we have?
It leaves most of this to Congress, but it says that every 10 years we have a census. The Constitution requires that decennial census, and it requires then that representatives in the House of Representatives be apportioned to the states in a fashion that reflects that most recent census. Then it says that no state shall have more than one representative for every 30,000 people, and each state gets at least one representative, that is, whatever its size. So the Constitution was written at a time when we had maybe up to 13 states, and 30,000 seemed to be about the right number. It created a House of Representatives in the first Congress with 65 members.
I ran the numbers. If we did 30,000 per district now, we'd have a Congress, a House of just over 11,000 representatives. Seems a little unwieldy.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, this ran into controversy pretty early on. You wrote on your Substack a while back that even the founders kind of disagreed over how to implement that basic guideline in the Constitution.
Well, they sure did. 30,000 is a nice round number, but it hardly ever divides evenly into the size of a state's population. So from the very beginning, the contending forces in American politics argued about how to deal with fractions. Alexander Hamilton had one point of view. Thomas Jefferson had another point of view. At the start, Congress adopted the Hamilton version, which basically said that if your state has the largest fraction, you get the next representative, and so on. Jefferson had a somewhat different formula. It turned out that President George Washington agreed with Jefferson and cast his very first veto of that congressional legislation, which was then written with the Jefferson plan, a somewhat more complicated plan, in mind. Politics was central to this from the start because the Jefferson plan allowed Virginia to get one more representative under his plan than under the Hamilton plan. And politics has infused the decision about what method to use for apportioning districts to states ever since.
Now, before we dig into the argument of whether to go past 435, why did we lock in just over a century ago on this magic number, 435?
For politics again. early in the century, in the late 19th century and early 20th century, the United States was growing very rapidly. We had a very large number of immigrants. There was a fairly large transfer of Americans, especially Black Americans, from the South to the North. And this filled northern urban areas, which became more and more industrial. And so the population became more and more northern and industrial. Republicans and rural political interests disliked this change thought that reapportioning seats or continuing to increase the number of seats in the House of Representatives would only give a bigger and bigger advantage to the North. So what happened was they decided first not to reapportion and not to increase or change the size of the House. Between 1789 and 1910, the House had increased in size every 10 years as the country grew.
We're talking to Steve Smith from Washington University about the idea of increasing the size of the U.S. House of Representatives. Now, one argument that made by the sponsor of this bill I mentioned and others is, okay, 1910, again, I checked the numbers, it was about 200,000 people per district. You have a chart on that Substack article I mentioned. Now we're knocking on the door of 800,000. So four times as many people represented by this same number of Congress folks in effect. Does this make them in some way less representative, do you think?
Well, that certainly is the primary argument for increasing the size of the House. Right now, the average district size is about 765,000, and we're going to be reaching a million here in a couple of decades. So if you think that having some personal contact with your legislator is important, and that the lower house, the House of Representatives of Congress, is the one place in federal government where you can have that, then you'd have to admit that having districts that approach a million are just way too large for having that kind of contact. Of course, the geographic size of districts really is not changing because we have not added states and states are not growing geographically. But the mix of political and economic and social interests in states and districts, of course, become more complex. And there's a good argument that a representative cannot get to know those people and those interests when those districts' populations are so large.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Nick is with us in Green Bay. Nick, hi.
Hi, thank you. I'm so happy to hear this topic. It's something I agree with. I'd love to see a more significant increase. The question I have is, if we increase the amount of representatives, thereby lowering the population that each representative represents, does that make it more difficult to gerrymander legislative districts?
Well, interesting question, Nick. What do you think, Steve?
Well, the gerrymandering, of course, is a function of state politics. And I will trust my state politicians to continue to pursue their partisan and political interests, no matter how many seats there are assigned to a state. So I don't think it gets rid of gerrymandering. There's plenty of gerrymandering already in state legislative contests or seats. So I'd expect congressional gerrymandering to continue. Now, it does mean that it might be a little bit easier to draw some district lines and to keep districts looking kind of normal, where they're not odd shapes, where all the parts of the district are sort of contiguous to each other. Certainly easier to get around those districts. But the gerrymandering, I don't think that'll end.
Thanks a lot for that call, Nick, at 800-642-1234. Steve, what would have to happen to increase the size of the House? There's a bill. Does that mean this is just normal legislation? If somehow it passed Congress, signed by the president, boom, we've got more representatives?
Yeah. It's not any more complicated than that. During the period between 1789 and the 19-teens, Congress every 10 years would revisit this question and would take into account the expected growth in population and set a new number that reflected that growth. It was regular legislation. Now, there were politics to that legislation, as you can imagine. It wasn't always easy to get that legislation enacted. Partisan divisions between the House and the Senate and the president oftentimes got in the way. But yes, that's all it takes, is a regular piece of legislation signed by the president.
Talking to Steve Smith from Washington University, looking at the U.S. House of Representatives, why it has exactly 435 members, even as the U.S. population keeps growing, and the pros and cons of a proposed law, a long shot, that would add a bunch of seats to the House. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should we add seats to the House of Representatives? What do you think the benefits could be? What worries would you have? What questions do you have about the political impact and some of the history behind this? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with political scientist Steve Smith from Washington University in St. Louis, looking at a bill in Congress that would add 150 seats to the U.S. House of Representatives. It's a long shot, it looks like. We're finding out why the House has stuck with 435 seats for over 100 years, even as the population has grown a lot. You can join in with your thoughts on the issue at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Steve, I assume, like, if I'm a member of a political party, I would worry that increasing the number of members of the House, you know, will it hurt my side or help my side? Big states, small states might ask the same kind of questions. Who potentially could win or lose by increasing the size of the House?
Well, that's a good question, and the answer is just a little complicated. Obviously, the most obvious interest at stake is the interest of the very smallest states. Wyoming, with roughly 550,000 people, gets one representative, even though the average size of a House district is now approaching 770,000. A state like Wyoming will lose arithmetically. It's one representative will end up becoming a smaller fraction of the total House if the large states gain a lot more seats as the overall size of the House increases. So there would be some opposition, I think, from small states. But you can imagine these new districts would be much smaller. So it's likely, for example, that the district lines would line up with local units of government, like county or city lines, a little bit better than they do now. It's possible that we'll have more districts that are really dominated by some minority interest. We'll have more Black districts. We'll have more Latino districts. And it could be that in some of these districts, a third or a fourth party, a minor party, might actually be more popular than the two major parties. So as you shrink those districts, it creates the possibility that these geographically concentrated interests in our politics will gain some formal representation in Congress, and the major parties might not like that. And of course, there are the current incumbents in the House of Representatives. They might prefer to be one of 435 than one of, say, 650. So their power would be diluted. And of course, in order to get the bill passed, we have to get a majority of those incumbent members to support the idea. So there's all kinds of sources of opposition, but many sources of support for this kind of thing.
Let's bring in another caller now. Jeff is with us in West Salem. Jeff, hi.
Yes, good afternoon. I would just like to bring up the fact that the general public should be getting the same benefits as far as health care and et cetera that the House of Representatives gets. And if you add another 150 House members, that's going to be a heck of a zap to the budget, if you ask me.
Jeff, thanks for the call. The cost of not just the members of the House, but the additional staff per member of House, Steve.
Oh, sure. Yeah, there are real costs to doing this. But, you know, to be honest, the cost of running Congress, while a substantial sum of money, is is peanuts in comparison with the size of the federal budget. So I don't think that can be our dominant concern. I think we have to worry about the quality of our democracy first. And when we decide what's best for the democracy, we ought to be willing to pay for it. But there are a number of considerations. The House chamber is already bursting at the seams. Individual, you know, of course, members there do not get individual seats or desks. They just crowd into the chamber. They have office space. Perhaps an additional office building would have to be put up. And as you say, they need to be staffed if they're going to do a good job of their representation. So, sure, there are real costs. There's no doubt about that.
Thanks for the call. One thing we don't talk much, Steve, about the job of being in Congress or on a congressional staff is constituent services, which is a lot of things. And I have seen concerns that given the size of the districts, the population of districts, I should say, that are being represented, that they're just overwhelmed. Can you talk about that side of the job that isn't always in the limelight?
Well, that's right. On Capitol Hill, it's usually called casework. It's where a constituent brings a personal problem, oftentimes with an executive or a federal agency. Maybe they want their son or daughter to get early release from the armed services because a parent recently passed away, and the family farm would go under if they don't get more help. A member of Congress might be called in to help them make the arrangements. Or someone has a problem with their Social Security check, they have someone on Capitol Hill to go to. Members of Congress spend a lot of time doing that. And they are struggling with this because their staffs have been essentially capped in size. The office budgets really have not grown much now for a couple of decades. And so personal staff has been pretty well fixed, even though the size of the population and the amount of casework they're expected to do has increased. Increase the number of members, it is certainly the case that constituents would have better access to members and their staff. And depending upon how much staff support we allow members of Congress to have, it could very well be that casework service will be improved.
Let's go back to our callers now. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi, I was just wondering about if your plan might include having districts cross state borders. So maybe you follow the population instead of just figuring, okay, well, we have to cut it off here because the state border is here.
Dennis, thanks for the call. As I understand it, Steve, we can't do that.
Well, not according to the Constitution. We can amend the Constitution, but that's a mighty lift. The Constitution does allocate House seats to the states. How the states choose to elect them is pretty much up to them, subject to quite a variety of federal and court regulations. There is another kind of twist to this. The current interest in increasing the size of the House stems in part from a group of reformers who would like to see the House move to proportional representation. So that the parties received seats in the House within a state in proportion to the number of votes they received. Supporters of proportional representation would like to increase the number of seats. Wisconsin has 10 seats, but if Wisconsin, say, had 15 seats, it could divide those seats among more parties or more directly in proportion to the votes. So there is a kind of a hidden agenda, actually not so hidden, among some reformers who would like to see us move to proportional representation and have the membership of the House then better reflect the proportionate support for the parties in the general public.
One quick clarification, 10 electoral votes in Wisconsin, 8 congressional seats.
Eight, 10 electoral votes, yeah, sorry.
Which brings me to, if we change the number of representatives, that affects the Electoral College, right?
Well, it would. If the Electoral College constitutional provisions were not changed, increasing the number of seats in the House would automatically increase the number of electoral votes that a state would receive. Now, remember, the seats in the House would still be allocated to the states, apportioned to the states according to their population. So the relative balance in the Electoral College across the states wouldn't change a lot. The one change that's obvious is for the very smallest states, which receive three electoral votes, one for their representative and one for each of their two senators. So they get three no matter their size. That might still be the case, but three, if we increase the size of the House, three would be a smaller part of the whole.
And briefly, Steve, hey, what about the Senate? That's two per state as things stand right now. Anybody thinking about changing that in any way?
Well, people think about it, but then they read the Constitution and they see that it provides for two senators per state. And then the Article 5 actually says you can't even amend that. Well, there's some legal dispute about whether it's truly unamendable, but it's pretty clear that it would be far, far tougher to change the membership of the Senate than the membership of the House.
Steve, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Oh, great to be with you. Have a good day.
You too. That's Stephen Smith, professor of social sciences and political science at Washington University in St. Louis. He joined us for a look at the size of the House of Representatives and what it would take to add more members to the House. There's still time for you to weigh in on that idea. Do you think the House of Representatives needs to be bigger so that district sizes, populations are smaller? Do you think that would make things more representative? Or do you worry about the impact of something like that? Let us know what you think over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, how old do you feel? And how does that compare to your actual calendar age? In a lot of surveys, people consistently say they feel younger than their age. Find out why and share your answers as we talk about some of the latest research. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll take a look at the unique flavors and dishes of Ukrainian food. We've got a Ukrainian-American cookbook author joining the show with us tomorrow. If this is the food you grew up with or you've encountered it, let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. That more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, a new immigration rule from the Biden administration would add restrictions for people seeking asylum at the U.S. border. Some advocates for immigrants say it looks a lot like Trump-era policies. We'll look at the proposal and what it would mean for immigration enforcement. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we look at the recent U.S. intelligence reports about the potential origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. First, the Biden administration is proposing a rule that would change asylum policy as it currently stands. Right now, under something called Title 42, a health law invoked because of the pandemic, immigration laws are being effectively overridden to turn away many asylum seekers under the theory that they could possibly increase a public health risk. With the COVID public health emergency ending on May 11th of this year, Title 42 border enforcement would end along with it. That raises questions about the number of people who could seek asylum. The Biden administration announced a proposed rule last month, which some critics say shows similarities to Trump-era immigration policy and angered some of the president's fellow Democrats. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about current asylum policy at the U.S. border? Do you think it's fair or not? Do you think changes are needed? Do you want to see those come from the Biden administration, or do you want to see Congress tackle these issues? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Dara Lind is a senior fellow at the American Immigration Council. Dara, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much, Rob. Good to be on.
I want to take this one step at a time. Take away Title 42, ignore for the moment this proposal from the Biden administration, and what would normal, quote unquote, asylum policy look like at the southern border?
Great place to start. And thank you so much for explaining Title 42 so well so that I don't have to. But under, you know, written immigration law, if you are apprehended by a Border Patrol agent, or if you turn yourself in either to Border Patrol or at a port of entry, like an official border crossing, and you say that you fear persecution in your home country, then you have kind of officially like started the asylum process. You have kind of you have invoked your right to seek asylum in the United States. And that means that if you have crossed illegally, or if you don't have a visa, so wouldn't otherwise be able to get into the U.S., you have to pass a screening interview which is called a credible fear interview with an asylum officer, which can take a few weeks, or you can just get released with a court date to eventually see an immigration judge, which is something that they do pretty frequently when there are too many people crossing for them to all get screened. So you ultimately don't have, or you initially don't have legal status per se in the United States. You don't have anything permanent. What you have is a pending court date and, you know, the ability to, after a certain amount of time, work in the United States while that court date is pending. And then ultimately you will be put in front of a judge to actually make your case that you've been persecuted based on your race, religion, national origin, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group.
Now, Title 42, long story short, this is a health law that's been used to say, no, we don't need to do any of the things you just said. I'm summarizing a lot there, Dara. That expires now. Now, we've got this Biden administration proposed rule that would, in effect, do what? What is the administration proposing here?
So the rule kind of creates this new process with a much higher and more convoluted series of bars. So for one thing, in theory, you would be unaffected by this. You would still be able to kind of seek asylum through the traditional route if you presented at a port of entry and had an appointment. Now, they've rolled out this app called CBP1 that's being used for some appointments right now to get exceptions under Title 42. I'm happy to answer some questions about the app, but like suffice to say, it is essentially being beta tested on asylum seekers, right? It's still very glitchy. There are still a lot of problems. It's wildly under available in terms of appointment slots for demand. So a lot of people even now can't get appointments, and it's only going to get worse once this is the only way to legally get asylum. So if you can't get an appointment via the app and you decide to cross into the US illegally, and you are a single adult or a family, you will have to demonstrate that you basically like that your life was imminently in danger in order to kind of qualify for normal asylum procedures. Under most cases, you're essentially going to be held to a higher standard in your screening interview. The technical term here is reasonable fear instead of credible fear. It's something that's usually used for people who don't qualify for asylum for like criminal history reasons or something like that. And it entitles you to a lesser form of protection than asylum, where you still can't be deported back to your home country, but you don't get the ability to have permanent status in the US. You can't have family members come join you, et cetera. So the way to get out of any of this would be that if you had demonstrated that you had applied for asylum in another country before arriving in the United States and you got rejected. And that's really what the Biden administration is banking on here. They're saying it's not a ban on asylum, period. It's an encouragement of using other countries' asylum systems, or barring that, using the legal ports of entry in the US. They're not, you know, outright posing a ban on asylum for people who cross between ports of entry, because U.S. law straight up does not allow them to do that. It says explicitly that you have the right to asylum no matter where you cross. So instead, they've just created these series of bars that apply only if you cross between ports of entry, while there's this huge crunch, you know, and not everyone who tries to apply at a port of entry is getting served.
I think one of the arguments to do something like this, Dara, is, okay, Title 42 is going to end. We've already seen in the last year or so a lot of people seeking asylum despite the existence of Title 42. The concern that there's pent-up demand, in effect, we're going to see more people than the asylum system can realistically handle. So we got to do, I guess, something to respond to this change. I mean, that premise, do you think that's valid?
I mean, I think that that is, I think that it's absolutely reasonable to be concerned about the U.S. immigration system's capacity to handle what comes next after Title 42, given that, as you said, like, even when people had no chance of getting asylum, if they crossed between ports of entry because of Title 42, they were still trying in, you know, numbers we haven't seen since before 9/11. But the question about capacity is really like, is the problem that too many people are crossing and getting caught, or is the problem that too few people are getting deported, or is the problem that too many people end up kind of stuck in limbo and, you know, passing the first screening but not passing their ultimate asylum claims Or is the problem that a lot of people are getting released from custody and dumped on the streets and don't have anywhere to go because they don't have family members in the US? Like, all of those are plausible concerns you can have with the capacity of the system, but they're very different concerns. And so the Biden administration is banking on the idea that if they make it harder for somebody to get released from custody quickly, because, you know, they're presumed ineligible, and they, you know, make it harder for somebody to pass their initial screening interview, that word is going to get back to people's home countries, and people who would otherwise start crossing are going to get the message, don't come. Now, there are real questions about how well that works, because we've seen in the past that, you know, even again, even under Title 42, where there's literally no way to get asylum, we're still seeing a lot of people coming. But it's also an assumption that, like, if it isn't proven correct, they don't actually help anything at all. They're just putting more people into a now more convoluted system, which is going to further tax those resources.
We're talking to Dara Lind, senior fellow at the American Immigration Council, looking at a proposed rule from the Biden administration that would change how people can seek asylum in the United States as a health policy called Title 42 will stop being in effect at the border in May. At least that's the current plan. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this proposal from the Biden administration? What would you like to see happen with asylum? What questions do you have for our guest? It's convoluted. There's a lot going on here. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. The conversation continues. Coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Dara Lind with the American Immigration Council, looking at the Biden administration's proposed changes to immigration and asylum policy as Title 42, a health law that's been used to prevent people having asylum hearings at the border. That's going to stop being used at the end of the public health emergency in May. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Jim is with us in Dubuque. Jim, hi.
Hi. I think we should do what they do in other countries. My sister moved to Colombia some years back in order to achieve a higher standard of living. And they, like most countries, including probably Mexico and most of them, you have to prove that you can support yourself so you won't be a burden on an already economically stressed population.
Jim, I gotcha. Thanks for that call. Now, Dara, as I understand it, some kinds of immigration, non-asylum immigration, that could be a requirement. Asylum, I think, works differently. Can you tackle Jim's idea there?
Yeah, absolutely. And I actually want to start with Colombia, because it's really interesting to bring that up as a data point. Colombia has had millions of asylum seekers from Venezuela for the last several years. They're taking way more as a percentage of their population than the US is, because it's a neighboring country that kind of couldn't, you know, there's a certain extent to which they couldn't do otherwise. But it's a good reminder that the US is in a really fortunate position that it even can, you know, control things like this, and that it is not, you know, that be like other countries doesn't actually mean be more restrictive in a lot of ways. But yeah, asylum and refugee status are purely humanitarian forms of relief. They're created in the aftermath of the Holocaust on the understanding that sometimes people really were in mortal peril from their own governments because of who they were. And so it's been, it's been kind of the one aspect of the U.S. immigration system as it gets increasingly arcane. And, you know, as legal immigration has gotten very slow in past years, that really adheres to the kind of Lady Liberty ethos, right? Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses. So that's kind of bedrock in U.S. law. You can't depend on economic support. What's interesting is that what the Biden administration has done at the same time that it's proposed this new rule is it's rolled out an expanded parole program for people from a few countries who had been putting a lot of asylum claims, including Venezuela, Cuba, Haiti, and Nicaragua. And that parole program allows people to come, like, buy an airplane ticket, fly into the US and work legally for 2 years and go and presumably go home. That's not based on an asylum claim at all. You don't have to prove anything about, you know, being persecuted, but you do have to have a family member or another sponsor in the U.S. who can demonstrate that they can support you for the 2 years that you're here, even though you theoretically have the ability to work legally. So it's very interesting that what the Biden administration is saying is like an alternative lawful pathway for asylum seekers is something that requires that kind of financial independence.
Jim, thanks for that call. Brian joins us next in Madison. Brian, hello.
Hi. So I had a question about like the larger political context. When it comes to anything immigration related, obviously, it becomes a hotly debated subject. But at the same time, we're having across the country like a huge shortage of workers for low paying and low skilled jobs. It seems like expanding immigration would be a good answer to that economically. And asylum seekers in particular seems like the obvious place to start. So I just don't understand, I guess, why this ends up being so convoluted and why making it trickier seems to be something that Democrats and Republicans both agree on, even though their rhetoric around it is a little different.
Brian, thanks for the call. Daryl, what do you think?
So there's a kind of structural problem with American immigration policy that Congress is supposed to be responsible for setting legal immigration levels, and then the executive branch is supposed to be responsible for like enforcing those laws, which includes, you know, doing a lot of figuring out how people who come to the U.S. without papers should be treated, since those people have, you know, broken the rule and are subject to federal immigration proceedings. But so what you end up having is, because Congress has not taken any action on immigration of note in this century, a situation where a lot of policy gets made through the executive branch. And because it includes a lot of people crossing the border without authorization, it gets turned into this question of border security, of crime, the assumption that people must be sneaking in for nefarious purposes, a lot of that. And so the idea of people as, you know, potential workers rather than potential threats is just pretty far from the way that, you know, the entire border bureaucracy is set up for enforcement. It's there's a separate benefits agency that in theory doesn't do any of this. So there's definitely a case to be made that there is, you know, an obvious demand and an obvious supply, and those two things should go together. But, you know, for exactly the reasons that I just laid out, like talking about asylum as potentially a way to recruit workers into the U.S. is just like, it's so far afield from the actual purpose of the program that it is a little bit weird to, you know, to even acknowledge that there is something there. The other thing I'd point out is that even though asylum seekers are theoretically legal or eligible for work permits after they file their applications, those work permit applications go through that benefits agency I mentioned, USCIS, which is totally swamped, has been totally swamped since before COVID, and it's only gotten worse from there. And so they are waiting just months and months and months for those work permits for which they are legally eligible.
Brian, thanks for that call. And just our last minute, Dara, I keep hearing about different parts of the immigration system, the one you just mentioned, the benefit system, the immigration courts, the list goes on. Being overwhelmed and understaffed. Is anybody in Congress and the White House talking about trying to boost the numbers there?
Well, USCIS is an unusual case because Congress has made the decision that immigrant user fees should pay for that agency. And so while there's been a little bit of support over the last couple of years because the situation has just gotten so bad, in general, that is supposed to be a fee-funded agency. And so when it does fall behind, it only gets worse because you can't spend any more than the amount of applications you have coming in. So that is just a problem that, absent a total about face from Congress that's going to cost a lot more money in the U.S. budget, can't really be fixed to a satisfactory degree.
And other agencies, including the immigration courts?
I mean, there have been proposals. There actually has been really aggressive hiring of immigration judges, both under the previous administration and this one. But it's really, there are just so many cases coming in that the backlog is getting all the worse. And you ultimately have to choose between, you know, really strict rules that make it difficult to postpone cases if you don't have a lawyer or if you haven't finished your application yet, that can kind of abrogate people's due process. And this inefficiency where, you know, if you have any potential delay in a case, you will take it because you're worried that if it comes to the end, you will ultimately get deported.
Dara, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Dara Lynn, senior fellow at the American Immigration Council. She joined us to talk about the Biden administration's proposed immigration policy that would change the process to seek asylum in the U.S. after the end of the COVID public health emergency coming up in May. Now, hundreds of book and magazine titles are banned inside Wisconsin prisons. That includes pornographic magazines and books that describe techniques for making weapons or illegal drugs. But the banned books list is also far-reaching enough to prohibit manuals on computer coding. And some advocates say the restrictions make it harder for people to expand their education while behind bars. Sarah Lear reports.
Marianne Olson spent more than 5 years behind bars in Wisconsin. While she was there, she says she asked for books to try and keep up with her prior career field of web design.
My incarceration was to help me understand not only why I made the poor choice I made, but to learn a better way. And in my mind, that meant a strong vocation.
But Olson, who had a job driving a van for the prison where she was incarcerated, says her access to those books was denied.
Here I am being handed keys to a vehicle and allowed to leave every day. And yet a book that would teach me how to use Microsoft Front Page was a security risk.
Prison officials screen inmates' mail and other reading materials. Wisconsin Public Radio used a public records request to obtain a list of the publications that have been approved or denied. The list shows officials used a policy banning anything deemed a threat to security to bar access to multiple computer literacy books. That includes titles like Coding Made Simple and Microsoft 10 in Easy Steps. Even so, the Department of Corrections says certain tech-related books could be allowed if they're part of a course an inmate's taking. A spokesman for the agency says the prison system has expanded its job skills and educational opportunities. But Moira Marquis doubts the logic behind many of the department's restrictions. She leads a prison writing program through an anti-censorship organization called Pen America.
The stated rationale, I think, is that people are going to develop into computer hackers and hack the, computerized systems of security at the facilities, which is a pretty far-fetched paranoid fantasy when it comes to a book like Windows 10.
Marquis believes concerns about security can snowball into banning a wide range of books that are considered subversive.
It's, I think, unlikely that security is really being served by limiting what people can read.
Wisconsin prison officials prohibited scores of books because they contained nudity or were deemed pornographic. A book describing how to fund a cannabis business is banned because prison leaders say it advocates breaking state law. So is one on rope knotting techniques, which officials say could be used to escape. The restrictions also extend into the realm of fantasy. In 2005, a Wisconsin inmate sued after his Dungeons & Dragons books and magazines were confiscated. That suit was dismissed after a prison captain argued the game could foster gang activity and encourage escapist fantasies. But prison reform activist Dante Cottingham says books, whether escapist or not, are a lifeline to people behind bars. He argues book bans are about imprisoning minds.
There's a deep sense of oppression inside prisons. That's simply another part of their oppressive intent to prevent you from growing, from feeling empowered.
Cottingham was released from Wisconsin prison last year. One thing he's enjoyed since getting out? Buying books that used to be banned. Sarah Lear, Wisconsin Public Radio.
To browse the full list of banned books and magazines, check out the online version of this story at WPR.org. Coming up after the news, we trace the origins of COVID-19 as much as we're able, plus the latest U.S. intelligence assessments, some pointing toward a natural transition, others saying that the pandemic may be the result of a leak from a Chinese government-controlled lab. We'll get the latest news and talk to a Wisconsin researcher. I'm Rob Ferret. You can follow these stories all the time, anytime, online at WPR.org or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. Either way, you can stream live this network, our classical music networks, and more, and check out our very extensive archives. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.